Hello, all. Welcome to another episode of That Creative Life. I am glad that you are with me today. Happy Monday. It's a new week. We have an exciting guest. His name is Emmett, and he has actually influenced a lot of brands that we interact with every day, or at least me. Sweetgreen, the go-to salad place for my everyday life here in New York. Hims, Hers, Harry's, Smile Club, so many things that he has worked on with the branding, and not only just help design it, but basically his company were the ones who did a lot of this branding and building apps and websites from the ground up. But I wanted to hop in before this podcast start and just ask a favor of you. If this podcast has helped you in your creative journey at all, may I ask of you to leave a podcast review on Apple Podcasts? It actually helps a lot. That's really the only outward facing thing that people see and kind of judge a podcast by, which is kind of interesting, right? So it would mean a lot. Let me know what your favorite guest is maybe, and you know how long you've been listening to, because it means so much. So enjoy this conversation. And at the end, I am answering your questions. So if you tag at That Creative Life, creative CRTV on Twitter, and then also hashtag That Creative Life. If you just tag me in a question, I will get to 3 to 5 of them at the end of every podcast. Gonna try to do it every podcast. We shall see every Monday. And that's all you have to do. Yeah, all the links will be in the description below if you wanna follow the socials as well as our wonderful guest here today. Enjoy. Welcome to That Creative Life. Hi, my name is Sarah Dici, and I am your host. I talk with artists, YouTubers, CEOs, and everyone in between. I hope this podcast helps you live your best creative life. Enjoy. What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of That Creative Life. I am here with Emmett Shine, and by the way, that last name is sick.
Thank Emmett you, Sarah. Happy to be Shine. Here.
Yes, it's so good to have you. We have a mutual friend, Nick Sharma. Mm-hmm. So I was texting Nick, and he texted me like a DTC brand. I was like, hey, you want to interview the founder? And I was like, oh, I don't know if I really connect so much with this product, but whoever did the website, hook me up with that person. I would love to chat with them. And so that's how we kind of ended up in the same room. So Emmett, tell me a little bit about yourself. Give the audience an intro. I think this is going to be a fun conversation.
Hey, I'm Emmett. And the last name Shine. You know, my parents are Irish on the dad's side, and then like a Norwegian Latvian on my mom's side. But my dad, it was, I think, like S-C-I-E-N-E, and then classic Ellis Island style. They just were like, Shine. So it's just like they just made it up as a word, essentially. But I'm not mad at it. I'm from Eastern Long Island. Grew up out there, Southampton. And then my mom is an artist, painter. My dad was a fisherman, and he's a landscaper. So just towny kind of style. And then I came to NYU, Tisch School for Photography a few years ago. Did a few years there and started doing graphic design and web design and helping out, you know, friends that were in the artistic kind of class. One thing led to another and formed an agency called Gin Lane out of doing freelance work. We worked with a lot of fashion brands like Stella McCartney and Theory and J. Crew and all that. And about 7 years or so, or maybe 10 years ago at this point, like we got introduced to Warby Parker, Bonobos, and Everlane in like the same few months span. And ideologically, I think we just really saw the world or commerce and branding and websites the same way, which coming out of dealing with more legacy, late 20th century thinking in the fashion sector was very refreshing, you know, having, you know, one user across all different touch points. If you're doing retail, if you're doing e-commerce, just, you know, I think so much of what they did that was radical was like customer experience, you know, like back in the day using the new mediums of Twitter and, you know, you'd tweet at Warby Parker and they would shoot a video on YouTube really quickly of try the frames on and send it to you. So I think we love that speed and that personalization, that customer service emphasis. And they also really saw that there was, you know, a need for good design and good branding. So we launched Harry's with one of the founders.
By the way, the fact that the same founder who founded Warby Parker also did Harry's is insane to me.
Yeah, it's almost like they're such nice guys, but it's like the PayPal mafia or whatever, yeah, and like tech lore, how like that has proliferated, and you know, LinkedIn and Elon Musk and Peter Thiel and all those guys.
DTC mafia.
Basically, yeah, it's like the Warby Parker, like UPenn Business School guys have just influenced everything. And, you know, we work with Sweetgreen, work with Reformation, and then later Hims and Hers and Recess and House, and did our thing. And then, you know, I guess I'm giving my whole life story.
No,
like
I love it.
10 seconds
because
or whatever.
Because what's so fun is, and I think a lot of people who are listening to this already are like, oh, Warby, Sweetgreen. These are brands that we interact with every day, especially me who lives in a city and is so, if a company saves me time, I'm going to give them all of my money. Sweetgreen, being able to go on an app, it's a seamless experience. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
Like how you choose your toppings is like flawless. You hit one button, you walk there, 5 minute walk, and you pick up your salad. And it saves time when there's a seamless experience and there's a good design that you can interact with and it doesn't get in the way. And, and so you've been a big part of this, and that's why it's honestly, I'm like giddy talking to you because I have so many questions. But recently, so you kind of made a transition from Gin Lane to Pattern Brands, and we're definitely going to talk about that. But for a few minutes, I want to just talk about Gin Lane, all the branding you've done, what you've learned, and you know, touched on some of the brands you've worked with, Hims, Harry's, Sweetgreen, Smile Direct Club.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you start working with these brands? Was it in the beginning? Did you have an influence on their first identity, or did you come in and say, oh, we need to solve all these problems, it doesn't look too hot, let's do this? What was that process like?
Yeah, I think it's like a mixed bag a little bit. So like Warby, Everlane, and Bonobos, they were already like existing as brands. They had just kicked off and started. And to some extent, I feel like we almost like did an apprenticeship with them. We would just go.
What year was this?
Man, I'm like 2000, I don't know, 10, 11, somewhere in that zone.
Wow.
The early days, like, you know, what's it called? But I think we just ideologically saw the world the same way. And so we would just go hang out and just talk about, oh, instead of building this in Java, why don't we try this in JavaScript? You know, like, hey, let's try to make the images move. Let's, you know, explore sprites where they're sequenced, you know, let's make this so you can click it. Let's make this, you know, mobile first. These things that seem so simple now, like interactivity, like, you know, emphasis on details, especially around digital. That was kind of our like special sauce. So we worked a lot with an agency called Partners in Spade, which is now called Mythology, but they did a lot of the initial work for some of those, you know, businesses, and they kind of were our entryway into that world. For Harry's, they did the brand identity, and we built the website and did a lot of the content creation. And the brief was just like, how do we make razors like fun and cool? And so our inspiration was like Beauty and the Beast, and so it's like all those little objects that come to life, you know, like the cup and chip and stuff, you know? And so how do we like make these razors seem fun and interesting in the website, and they're moving around, they're spinning. And, you know, Sweetgreen, the same kind of like, they were already existing, but we basically built and architected their, you know, online ordering experience, starting with web and then going to a native app. And we like studied how they were just opening it. They weren't in New York yet. So we went down to DC a bunch and would study like how, what were they doing that made it so special, you know? And again, this emphasis on customer experience. And so we watched how they would, you know, treat their employees and treat customers. Two of our team actually worked the lines for like a month or so on and off just to get like a method actor real experience. And that influenced some of like, you know, you can see the different components of the salad as they make it. And so we try to replicate that visual top-down kind of experience with components. And then, you know, being able to save stuff, move things around, just making it seamless, making it fun, making it beautiful. Like at the time, we had a few friends that worked at Apple, and we would always just joke that we were trying to make like, you know, a more beautiful app than they could make when we were just a few kids in Chinatown. But the guys from Sweetgreen were, you know, they were very supportive of like pushing out. We built everything from scratch. There was no architecture or, you know, SaaS products at that time that could do what we wanted to do. It was like, you know, I think it was like Micros POS was like the default at the time. This is before, you know, kind of this explosion in like fast casual technology in the last like half a decade.
For people who aren't on the coast, because I feel like Sweetgreen is predominantly East Coast, they might be saying, so what? They make salads and it's an app. But there's a certain experience to the Sweetgreen app, like I said, that I challenge you, just download it, even if you don't have a Sweetgreen by you, because when you interact with it and how the ingredients, how you can so easily add an ingredient, get rid of an ingredient, it's like no other app experience that I've ever used, right? And so because you didn't have, I guess, a lot of examples, what was the process? You said people, you know, worked the lines, they understood in and out Sweetgreen. But from a technical standpoint, since you said you kind of had to build it from the ground up, what were the first steps that you took to build that app, the ordering side of it? Because just, I mean, the ingredients look beautiful, how it moves is crazy. I mean, how'd you break that down?
Yeah, I think we tried to replicate what was special about their in-store experience, and basically like separate that out from the store, and then look at the medium and the interface, which predominantly would be your phone, but also desktop at the beginning. So just screens, and how can you take what was special, and then basically insert it into a different medium and a different user experience. And so I think that's just a common theme where we try being user first and having, you know, a higher empathy or EQ, which I think sometimes is really hard. And like digital is like, it's not that old, it's still new. And I think it like of this, like it's a triangulated like interface. It's not one-to-one as a human or a physical object. And I think the ways we relate to it are still being figured out. And so in some ways it's very easy to make like assumptive mistakes, but it's fun to take steps back and say like, what if, you know? And so I think we took from the Sweetgreen experience, it's very visual, it's very clean and modern, it's very friendly, it's very user-centric. There's a lot of information, you know, how much calories is this? What farm is this from? You know, like all these different components. You can personalize salads, you can save salads. And so I think we tried to transpose some of those elements into a digital interface and just think what would be delightful to a customer, and then reverse engineer from that.
Mm-hmm. All of these brands are very visually driven, but at the end of the day, you need programmers, you need people who on the more technical side to make, you know, make it go. So I know you've made a transition recently, but what was your team like at GenLane? How many designers did you have? How many programmers? Were the programmers also designers? Because what I've noticed being on a side of trying to build a software product, a lot of the time, because the programmers are making it, it seems like, hey, they have more say, right? And it seems like design is a afterthought, which can be challenging to a lot of, I think, designers out there who maybe feel like they don't have power because they can't code or whatever. So I'm curious, what was your team like? What was kind of the, you know, did coders program, did programmers design? How did you balance that?
Yeah, we, when we launched Harry's to market, we were about like, this is maybe almost 7 years at this point, we were about 22 full-time staff. And when we started Pattern, more or less officially last year, we were 24 full-time staff. So that kind of was like our sweet number. At the peak of our Sweetgreen work, maybe about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, somewhere in that zone, we had almost 10 full-time engineers because it was so much development work. We're at like 4 or 5 right now, which is like our kind of sweet spot, just under like a half dozen. I would say that like we've always tried to imbibe like or infuse a sense of design to all of our team. I think that's really important. And even the developers, it's like have an appreciation for, you know, art, for culture, for design theory, you know, having talks and debates on like, you know, concepts of like visuals essentially. And so like front end development is essentially like modern design. Like digital design is so blurred. If you're, you know, a user interface or user experience designer, you have to be to some extent fluent and understand the basic principles of, you know, HTML and CSS and like the mechanics and movements and machinations essentially of like these interfaces. There's a lot of work that's been done to make it more accessible and easier if you're like a young designer, or not even young, if you're someone entering into that world. But I think going back, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, we would always have the design and development and usually a strategist all work very closely together, almost like pods or teams, so that it's not as like waterfalled. I think that's where you get kind of like, you know, a designer is thinking of something that's completely abstracted from reality, and you're having a developer who's then frustrated and saying, dude, I've got 40 hours to do this. Like, screw that. We're doing it my way. And they're very more, you know, oriented around, rightfully so, making things work. So I think you need the good tension. And then also a strategist has to say, like, the why, you know, like Socratically kind of style, like, why, what's the purpose? Why does this matter? What's the emotional benefits, you know? So I think if you have a good designer, a good strategist, and a good developer kind of working together, that's where you can get these like special breakthrough concepts or products in the digital space.
I don't know if you pay attention to design Twitter. I'm on Twitter all the time, but they're always getting so angry about so many things all the time. And there is a big debate whether designers should know how to code or not. And like anything in life, you can have a mix of all things, but there's some really passionate people out there that say, no, designers don't need to know how to code. This is why. And there's passionate people that are like, designers need to know how to code, and this is why. Do you have any opinion on that? It might be me and my Twitter bubble, but it seems like people are super passionate about it.
Yeah, I think design is such like a catch-all word, you know? I think there's a lot of awesome designers that, you know, don't do or work on anything digital. And I think that's important to, you know, acknowledge and appreciate. I think, you know, there's designers who work on physical products, who work on, you know, print, who work on, you know, an airport layout, on street signs. So I think design is such a... The design, I think, has emerged or reemerged, I don't know, as like a very important area of, I don't know, of life. You know, I think that people understand now, like, you can design kind of like how you navigate through life. And I think, you know, bad design, it's like, I'm a Jets fan. I'm from Long Island. And the joke is always when you go to Jets games, when you cross over to New Jersey, just the design of the highway systems and the signs is like, it's just a joke unto itself. Everyone's always making the wrong right turn because it's kind of like next right, but you're looking at the right, but it means don't take that right. It's the next right. So as it relates to like design Twitter, I think they're more talking about like, you know, digital designers, product designers, user interface, user experience designers. And I would say there's two sides to that coin or whatever, to like, to each his own. I think it's good to have base knowledge, because if you're working with, you know, other individuals that you have to align with to get an end product done, you know, it helps to have somewhat of a, like a lingua franca, to know a commonality of what is needed. I think how far you go down that rabbit hole, that's where it's kind of to each his own. I don't think a good, you know, digital designer has to, you know, be a really good developer. That may not be the, then you're kind of, as a specialist, almost generalizing yourself versus being a true specialist. And so I think if you have those extra hours to think and, you know, contemplate or practice your craft, I think it's always better to go deeper as a specialist. Mm-hmm. It's like a T-frame specialist or whatever. So like you can go really deep, but you also have a bar up top that has some horizontal to it. I think that's really important also for a developer. I think they should be very, you know, focused and understand their craft and stay up to date on the progresses and where things are going, but have a strong point of view. But they also should be able to have a conversation and appreciation for what a designer or a strategist or, you know, a product manager is bringing to the table.
Right. What are some of things in real life, like you said, the highways that get you frustrated? What are some examples of like where design miserably fails and you're just like, why is this like this?
Everything. I mean, I think
I'm sure it's very frustrating, yeah, for you to be out,
yeah,
in the world.
I mean, well, it's like a joke for anyone who's worked with me or knows me, like I'm the least like competent human being on planet Earth. You know, like part of like the Sweetgreen app or a lot of these things was like, I can't do anything. It just, everything is too frustrating for me. Like I'm just like a little Larry David, you know, like just constantly I'm getting into you know, PG arguments with people at coffee stores or whatever. Like, I just think so much of life is like, there's so much assumption. It's like, oh, you didn't know that's what I meant? Or like, and I'm like, my brain doesn't have the good assumption filter. So I'm like, no, I walked completely the other way. Or like, no, I asked for that. And so I think I just tried taking, it's like, if stuff works for me, it always works for everyone else.
That's so good, yeah.
And like, for a lot of e-commerce and a lot of web stuff, I always say it's like, going to restaurants for me is always hard because I like, I'm fully literate, I can read, but I'm almost like dyslexic of
process,
of understanding what something is. And so when you go to a restaurant, you go look at food, and it's all words that are from, you know, they're mixed in, some, you know,
trying to be cuisines, fancy,
and I'm always like, I need a waiter or waitress to say, okay, here's the deal. Like, I'm not eating meat. I'm at like a 7 out of 10 of hungry. This appetizer thing looks pretty good, but I don't really know how big that is. I want it to be a little warm because I want something warm right now, you know. And then for the entree, like, I don't know, I kind of want to split it with my girlfriend. Like, what do you think? And they're like, oh, totally. Like, you should get the burrata with this. And then for that, like, get the cacio e pepe and we'll split it. You know, I'm like, awesome. But yeah. I couldn't do that on my own, just looking at a piece of paper that, again, Sweetgreen, it's super visual. It shows everything. Like,
sounds like you need to redesign the restaurant business. I think that's your next step.
We got deep into that game, and it's like entrenched. Places are entrenched. Yeah. I always say, like, gravity is really strong, and the pull of gravity is like best practices and common thinking. And you know, it takes a lot of willpower and a lot of energy to like push against the status quo or conventional wisdom or what is expected. And I think for me, it's like picking and choosing my battles of just trying to, like, I don't know, redo a lot of the everyday moments that you like, you know, encounter during, you know, whatever.
Yeah. This is a good transition into pattern brands, because the motto is a family of brands designed to help you enjoy daily life. And so going from something that is strictly branding and advertising and building things for other people, why did you start Pattern Brands?
Yeah, I think a few reasons. One, we had done Gin Lane for over a decade. And you know, and
by the way, is this rude? How old are you? Cause you look so young.
I just turned 36.
Congrats.
Yeah.
You look great. Look young.
Yeah. Got to use moisturizer.
Yeah. Know? I love it. Well, the fact that you started such an operation at 25, 26 is crazy. It's like, awesome. Yeah, to like have 24. That under your belt. Yeah.
Yeah.
24. Yeah. So sorry, I interrupt you. Pattern Brands.
Yeah. No. So yeah, we were doing Gin Lane for a while, and it was going well. We had our best years the last few years, but I think, you know, our team are people who are insatiably curious, and I think we like challenges, and I think, you know, it's one of those things, and if people are listening, you know, it's like when you're coming up in the game, all you want is someone to say yes, you know, you're like, I'll do anything, just someone give me a shot, you know, and you always remember, it's like your first kiss or something like that. You always remember the first jobs where people like believed in you because you're so like vulnerable and going through like, can I do this? Can I try? I don't know. And the voices in your head and maybe people even around you are like, get a real job, you know? So you always remember like those first people that believed in you. Like I definitely still do to this day. And then if you can get good at something, it gets to this weird point where you have to learn how to say no. And that's like,
oh, preach.
That's it's like a hard thing because you're transitioning. It could be over years or it could be fast where you just want to gobble up every opportunity that comes across your way. And then you have to switch it to a place where you have to really understand your time. You have to understand that, you know, time is worth more than money. It's the great democratizer. Jeff Bezos and you have the same thing. You have 24 hours every day. Yeah. You know, everyone has time, and what you do with your time, which I'll come back to, I think is something that we don't, as especially a young version of our society, I think really have a deep understanding of. And so I think for Gin Lane, we got to this place where we wanted to more challenge ourselves, and we also wanted to have our time be focused on something that we felt was new and different. We also wanted to try to go deeper on our projects. Being a service provider, you know, there are different ways to do it, but we were always project-based. And so we never wanted to really do retainers because we always wanted to keep challenging ourselves, you know, like not get complacent or whatever. That was just our kind of take on it. And so by this notion, we can build brands and continue to work on them for hopefully years to come. We also wanted to keep a lot of our core team together, and we were getting older as a group, and you know, people we have are really good. They could go run their own businesses. And so to us, Pattern was a way that we could, in theory, explore how to keep growing individually, because there's more terrain to frontier explore. And the third, which I think is like pertinent to the mission, is that we had tried to grow the agency a few years ago, instead of just being 22, 24 people, you know, chilling in the startup world, like we're good at this. We got some phone calls by, you know, some big companies, and they were like, hey, you guys are really good at what you do. We want to give you a shot of trying to do this on like a national level, you know? And so, we'd done some work with Apple, with Bose, with GE, and then Whole Foods came, and they're like, hey, we have this new concept. It's a store called 365. You know, we want you guys to architect all the digital, everything for it. Just build this whole ecosystem, integrated retail, online. We're going to have every single product in the store is going to be on the website, and it's going to show where it's from. It's going to show what it's made of, the vitamins, the nutritional value. You can pre-select stuff, go in the store and pick it up. You can scan the stuff in the store to understand how healthy it is for you. We were like, okay, this is incredible. Let's give it a try. And it almost like broke our company. It was so hard. It was so much work. It was dealing with like a 24/7 enterprise operation that was on all the time. We were integrating with Accenture for like, you know, back end technology and accounting. We ended up completing it, and then like a year later, they basically sold to Amazon.
Yeah. So that was before.
This was before, yeah. And in some ways, like a lot of that thinking allowed them to have more of a fluency in dealing with a technology company.
Right.
So in some ways, our work was really influential and instrumental. It got absorbed back into the mothership of Whole Foods, which made them more able to, you know, interface with a company like Amazon and what they're doing with Whole Foods now. You know, you can see being played out. But it was really hard, and basically, long story short, it burnt us out. And we were like, man, let's just go back, go back to our little like cave of creativity, you know. But we remembered it was just like, we're adults. We don't want to be working. We're getting married. We're having kids. We're starting families. Like, we don't want to be working 7 days a week, 60, 80 hours, you know, plus. Like, why is this considered normal? You know, right. This sucks.
I mean, that's a good question to bring up, and having the self-awareness of that, because I think we, at least for me, being in New York, for people who are kind of in these cities where a lot of stuff is happening, it's the culture of always wanting more and grow.
Yeah.
And especially when you're working with startups, it's the idea of, hey, you go crazy for maybe 2 or 3 years and there's a big payoff, but then there's always something more on the other side, right? And so sometimes you kind of have to stop and ask, okay, is this what we really want? And a lot of times when you're growing, what I found is it can get to a point where you're not even making more money. You're just getting bigger jobs and paying more salaries. You're just hiring more people.
Yeah, it's like I said a few times, but like basically all like biological stuff on Earth, there's three phases to it. And I'm not making this up. I'm just like paraphrasing smart people stuff. But it's growth, maintenance, entropy. That's it. Everything. Like everything is born, everything dies. And in the middle, you're trying to maintain.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think in America, especially as this like the shining, you know, hill on top of the shining city on top of the hill, there's such an emphasis from capitalism on growth.
Yeah.
And so really in America, I think that we only look at 1/3 of the equation of life. So basically it's like, hey Sarah, how's your business doing? And if you were like, oh, it's maintaining.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be like,
that's not sexy, right?
Well, yeah, I'd be like, is everything all right?
Yeah.
Let alone, you know, it's like, what do you do when your parents are getting older, when your grandparents are getting older, when you're getting older? Like, entropy is something. My dad went through some health stuff this year, and I got like, I didn't want it, but I got a, you know, a close up look at like the healthcare system in America and what you have to go through and what the defaults are. And he's, you know, a tough guy, and we got a good family and big Irish, you know, Long Island family. So you make everything humorful and you're always laughing and trying to get through. That's your like coping mechanism. But you see a lot of other individuals that don't really have the families that are there. They don't really have, you know, maybe good healthcare set up, and they're just relegated kind of to the shadows, like literally and metaphorically of society. And so I think that's like a frustrating thing, where also I think design is something that like I hope more and more continues to hit these important areas and sectors, you know, of our culture. I think making stuff, you know, that we just ended up where we ended up of making salad apps cool and brands cool. But I really do think good design thinking and consumer centric thinking and having higher EQ, which I think will be more important continuing, you know, especially with like automation and et cetera. It's I think EQ becomes more important than IQ. And so I don't even know where I started here, but.
No, I mean, I think that's such an important point, and also why I think with automation and all these things, I think there is going to be a big swing eventually back into human experience. And, you know, you talk about your frustration with restaurants, which is so true. But I think that's why it is so important to have the human aspect of the waiter there, because they can really personalize that experience. When you go to a store, you got to at least have product, and two, have a really good human experience, because that's the only reason why someone's going to that store. They want someone's opinion. They want help, right? And so I think that's where I cling on to a little bit of hope of the future, where because everything is probably going to be automated, maybe we'll have this yearning of human connection and, you know, in public spaces, who knows. But growing up in Long Island, being from a family who appreciates art too with your mom, I think that's so cool. On the Pattern Brands website, you can see some of her watercolors that she made, which are beautiful. What was that like growing up in a family that your mom was an artist? I mean, not a lot of families can appreciate beautiful things.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're growing up, you know what you know, and that's all you know. Yeah. And so everyone who's listening has grown up with their own family quirks and stuff. And some of it, you may get older and realize you have a lot in common with other people. And some you may realize that you had some quirk that's quite unique to you. And I think things that are different many times can be seen as, you know, negative or alienating. But I think just embracing the stuff that is quirky is what really gives us uniqueness. It's like, even at like a DNA level, it's like the quirks make someone's hair or some, you know, personality trait different. And so I think for me, like, you know, I just thought everyone's mom was like an artist or a painter. You know, I didn't.
I think most parents are like, get an engineering degree, screw the art.
Yeah, like she doesn't even care. She doesn't care about like, you know, like success in whatever sense. She's like, she doesn't even care about money and not even in like she literally is like more down with like barter system of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's like there's also the stereotypes of artists, you know, it's like hippy dippy kind of, it's like, it's not like ripping, successful, selling huge paintings artist. It's like just doing it because it's in their blood.
Yeah.
And so she cares a lot about like integrity and artistic integrity, and I think that's something that like I try always having as a motivator for me or an inspiration is like, you know, would my mom or other people who care very deeply about their craft or craftsmanship or design-led thinking, would they respect what we're trying to do? Right. If it works, that's kind of like the tension, the dichotomy. Like we want to build products and brands that work and perform. Right. But I still, try to do it in ways that like, I think people who care about the craftsmanship can appreciate.
Yeah. Do you have siblings?
Yeah, I have a sister who's 4 years younger. So basically she's like my big sister. Mm-hmm. She's just like, was way more mature from an early age.
Yeah.
Like even in high school, she would be in middle school and people would, you know, I was even doing entrepreneurial stuff kind of back then or whatever. And people were like, Amanda, you know, you must be so proud of your younger brother. You know, and she was like 15, but they would just think that she's so mature, you know?
Yeah.
So she's great. I talked to her like 18 times a day still.
Yeah. It's cool that I'm kind of jealous of your dynamic that you can have your family only 45 minutes, an hour away from you, but you can still experience the craziness of New York with Texas. I guess Austin is cool, but there really isn't anything like New York. So what was it like growing up pretty close to the city, hanging out with your friends, doing creative stuff, skateboarding? Fun fact, you designed Casey's first website, Casey Neistat?
Yeah, we did the Neistat brothers website back in the day.
Back in the day. Yeah. So you really have your roots here with, you know, a lot of the people that we associate with now that have come into their own creative thing. It seems like there really was a fun culture, a fun little group of people back in the day.
Yeah, so I'm from Southampton, which is like 2 hours outside the city, 2.5 hours. But like even growing up,
it was closer.
Even growing up, I never really came to the city. It was like just like a country bumpkin kid. Mm. And I came in a few times in the 90s. We would take the train in and go skateboarding. Like we would go to the Supreme store in like 1996. It was like a skate shop. It wasn't even like the Supreme that it is now.
Because it started in 94, right?
Yeah. And like we would go down to this spot called the Brooklyn Banks, which was like, you know, the legendary kind of skate spot at the time.
Which, rest in peace, it's now.
Yeah. I mean, you can still see people going there and doing little stuff. But now they got like the Lower East Side Skate Park, which our office is right by, which I wanted to just be by the skateboarding action. But yeah, all my friends, we just, you know, we're just little nerdy 90s skate rats. And we would just skateboard all the time and, you know, I don't know. I think it was like we were all trying to be creative, all trying to, you know, make t-shirts and make our own little skateboarding companies and, you know, make little videos like 411 videos and stuff. And then when I came to the city for NYU, I knew a good amount of people in the city because they had come out in the summers or whatever. And I'd meet interesting, weird little kids. They would come. We had a skate park called Lola Prentice, and they would come skateboard with us. And so, you know, when I came to the city, I knew the little kids that were hanging out with Casey, you know, and just the same kind of strata of just downtown creative, you know, people trying to do different things, you know, that were from weird homes and, you know, just for whatever reasons were just kind of, you know, ruffians running around trying to make things happen in a way that wasn't just getting a job. And so I think birds of a feather flock together and you find your people. And then it's been pretty cool watching what, like, you know, this groups of people have done, like the movie Uncut Gems coming out, you know, with the Safdie brothers and, you know, friends with the guy Sibo who helped produce it. Just, it's awesome to see, people that I have just come into contact with is just, oh, cool. Hey, you seem like a cool guy. And then years later, they're just doing culturally significant, awesome stuff.
And a lot of people sometimes don't see the 20 years before of those, yeah, those times.
There's always 10 years behind every overnight success.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I think people with the internet, they tend to just take a screenshot of where people are now and they assume that, oh, and I understand a lot of skepticism because a lot of times in this world, it's like, oh, their dad is this, their mom is that. But at the same time, anyone successful out in the world, you gotta put in a little bit of work, even if your dad is this, your mom is this. But a lot of these people, it's been really fun to see because you take a step back, you watch their videos from 15 years ago, and you're like, oh, they've been putting in the work for 10, 15, 20 years. And to see it now has been so cool. And to also take a step back and look at who was hanging out with who. And oh my gosh, there's so much cool creative energy. And it's so funny to always see. I feel like either skateboarding or music always seems to be at the center of a lot of these cool groups coming together. Do you still skate?
Yeah, I still do. I'm like a old guy starter pack, you know. It's like, let's meet at the skate park at 8 a.m. It's like, bring the Advil.
I love that. You need to meet my boyfriend John because he's always hitting the park at like 7, 8 a.m. You guys need to have a sesh together. That's so fun. Okay, talk a little bit about your first brand with Pattern Brands, Equal Parts. What is it?
Yeah, cool. So on the pattern side, what we're trying to do, like the motto is like enjoy daily life. And talking a little bit about the burnout stuff, I think we kind of saw this opportunity to build a series of brands that are based on kind of everyday routines for young adults, you know, people that are in their late 20s, early to mid 30s. And we looked at areas of the house that we thought could help anchor and support healthy routines. And so basically, you know, a lot of research, again, going back to like US culture, and that's how I got into that, you know, health kind of stuff, is like growth, maintenance, entropy. It's just grow, 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 work, 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 work more, work more, earn more, work harder. And it's for what? It doesn't make you happier. It doesn't make you more fulfilled. And so like, can as a society, especially the young adults that are emerging to start dictating societal culture, say we don't need to work 60 hours a week. This doesn't make me happy. It doesn't make me actually save more money. And so I think for us, one thing that we thought we could influence is putting an emphasis on like the mundane, routines and habits, and trying to make daily routines and habits something that is cool again to look at. Because I say, what is the inconvenience of convenience? And everything we do to be convenient is so that we can work more. And so, like,
ain't that the truth?
And cooking at home and stuff is like a lost art in America. Like, it's fallen off a cliff the last few years because young adults are working so much and they're also really drained. The anxiety, like, these are real issues that are skyrocketing the last few years. And so you come home and basically, like, if you read the books like Flow or Finding Flow, the concept of flow, like the author, Czech Mihai, I think his name is, he talks a lot about like activation energy and things. He wrote this in the 90s about like TV, you know, but basically like using your phone and social media, et cetera, it requires a low activation energy, a lower activation energy. So it's easier to just hop on your phone, order something on Seamless, scroll through social media, put on Netflix, and just kind of plop on the couch, and there's your night. That's not bad to do. We all do it. But, you know, coming home and like turning the stove on, getting something out of the refrigerator, cooking it up, what's good about it is not just like the normalness of it. There's a lot of hidden benefits. It's like those super fruits or something that have like antioxidants and stuff in them, but actually taste good. Yeah. So basically it's like, it's mentally healthy for you because you're not looking on your phone. You're not thinking about work. You're focused. Your hands and your mind are doing the same thing. You can get into flow state, which you could do is if you were like running or surfing or rock climbing or, you know, playing music, but you can do it at home on a daily basis. And so our first brand is in the cooking area. And so we tried to make, you know, responsibly sourced products that they heat up faster, they clean faster. And we also have coaches. So we have certified professional chefs that you can talk to that help. Really, they're just like encouragers. They send nightly nudges. They send, you know, recommendations, and you can talk back and say, I just got home. It's 7 o'clock. Like, I want to make something. I'm kind of tired. Like, can I just tell you what's in my fridge? And like, sure, no doubt. Like, let's see what you got. And cool. And it's been helping people cook, you know, overall as a brand that are interfacing with us more. Mm-hmm. And so we'd love to get more people that aren't really having routines around cooking. But right now we're focused on people who do have routines around cooking, supporting them and strengthening them, right? Because they're the core group, which are saying, I understand the value of this in my life, but I still struggle with it on a weekly basis. Hmm. And our subsequent brands, our next one is coming out at the end of January, are going to be in the home and in different areas and categories that we interface with on a daily basis, but to some extent have disregarded the importance of them because they're not seen as optimizer categories. They don't make us more money, or they don't help us with our work. But if you look at other like cultures and societies around the world, there's so much more of an emphasis on balancing your life. It isn't just all about work. You're not identified by, you know, who you, in New York, you meet anyone at the bar, the first thing they ask is, what do you do? That's your identity. And I think what we're just trying to do a little bit is make people's identities more reflective of who they want to be as a person.
Amazing. You seem like an extremely thoughtful person, which I really appreciate. With taking these a little bit of more ownership with these brands, is there a side of it though that hey, we want a bigger slice of the pie because Harry's sold for $1.4 billion to Schtick and we had a big part of that? We didn't make the company, but hey, designing it and being a part of that aspect of it really is so much of the process. So was that one of the motivators as well of like, hey, we want more ownership? There probably is a bigger payoff at the end of the road, but what is that payoff for you? Is it building brands and selling them, or building these brands and really just seeing it through until the end of time?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, from an earlier age or whatever, I woke up and realized the value of what we were doing.
Totally.
You know, and we have small pieces of equity and Harry's and Sweetgreen and Hims and Hers and all these brands we work with, which we fought really hard to make sure we had some upside because we felt our work was way more valuable than just the cash that the market said this work is worth. You know, if we do our job right and we contribute and work really hard, we can help brands be very successful. It's a very special time. I think I like try reading and stuff, and like this, you know, Andrew Yang style, like third industrial revolution or whatever, fourth industrial revolution, we would call it. Like, you know, digital services and creativity and all the stuff going on right now. It's crazy. It's special. It's not the last 25 plus years are just incredible that you can, especially with the internet, it's so democratized. Anyone can do or access, you know, areas of learning or information or communication, but to be really good at it, that last 20%, it's very valuable, especially with like how back in the day we used to, you know, build a lot of websites by hand, and now you can build an e-com website, you know, through Shopify at just the same clip. So the little nuanced differences, if you're in that strata for what you do, they're almost invaluable. And so I think it's knowing your worth and leveraging that. And so for us doing Pattern, it obviously we own it, so that's great. But I think from a financial perspective, to me, I always say like money is a shadow of passion. Mm-hmm. Like I think if we're just very passionate about what we do, that can stand out and people can see and recognize that. And then, you know, success in the monetary sense could come. But I try not to make that the motivator for us or our team. Obviously it exists, but I really want, you know, I think for Pattern, it's like, we have theses that I think we're trying to explore within the consumer space. Can we build, you know, basically like Patagonia 2.0? We're trying to be very mission conscious. We're trying to be responsible. We're trying to use good materials. We're giving 1% of all of our revenue back to charity. They have Give One for the Planet. They have 1% for the planet. We started something called Give One. You know, I think the way that we're trying to build our work culture, which is hard because there is an emphasis still on growth, but we're trying to, you know, also focus on maintenance. And sometimes, you know, people that you have to let go or transfer over. So you can call that like entropy, I guess. Mm-hmm. So trying to think about just that whole cycle, the cycle of life within a business. Mm-hmm. We're trying to be transparent. We're trying to share our notes, what's working, what's not working. I think we're trying to be communicative also, saying for equal parts, we launched it. Here's some things that didn't make sense that customers told us, that people online told us, and answering them back, talking to them, listening, and then responding. My whole goal is don't try to win by being the smartest in the room. Just try to win by listening and being the fastest to iterate.
Yeah. That's dropping some truth. Okay, a few more questions. With this new wave that we're seeing of brands, and there's definitely a side of things where I think consumers are way more conscious of what they're consuming. Hey, what materials is this made out of? You know, there's that side of it, but there's also the side of how we're receiving things. And we talked about Seamless. I am that person. I am so tired by the end of the day. I sit on my couch. I put on reruns of The Office and I order my Thai food off Seamless and it's at my door in 25 minutes. And for me, and maybe it's because, you know, because I believe half of it is nurture, the nature versus nurture thing. And I'm so glad that honestly, I was like born in the time I was, because I feel like I could not be able to function any other way than just doing my own ish, you know, trading off, hey, I want to work more for maybe the trade-off of like, I hate cooking, but I'm also really intrigued by, you know, your first brand. I think that's so cool. But people are consuming things differently. They have options now. And the whole direct-to-consumer movement, I think I saw a tweet where you or someone else like kind of rephrased it with direct with consumer instead of direct to consumer. So can you kind of talk to this new trend and how maybe also it seems a little cyclical too, where I think we are going to end up in a state of, you know, like, oh, people have gotten away from cooking. How can we use new methods to get back to the old grooves of things? But yeah, kind of walk me through what you've experienced in the past 10 years and how people consume products differently.
Yeah, I think, look, you know, like the age cohort of a millennial in America is like, you know, has the most purchasing power. And I think that a lot of, you know, this age group, you know, kind of came into the job market after the Great Recession or around that time. And
we've only lived in prosperity. It's only gone up.
Right? Yeah, I mean, again, this is where like history and stuff is, you know, interesting. It's like 1989, 1990, 1991, the U.S. becomes the sole superpower in the world. And so like the 90s are for many people, but again, that's what America's crazy. It's like a banana republic, right? So it's like, you know, minorities or, you know, people of color or people from lower economic backgrounds, like America is a tough place, mm-hmm. in many ways, because you're staring at like the greatest wealth in the world. That's what I felt like growing up in the Hamptons. Like, I'm a normal guy from a normal family, and some of the richest people in the world are right there every day. And that's
I've never heard the US metaphor be compared to a banana republic.
Well,
but yeah,
it's just like the inequality index or whatever, like the GINI Guinea or whatever. Yeah. Like, the US is so high compared to other industrialized nations. And so, but what I was saying is that like the 90s would be like simplified as a time of just like mass prosperity, right? And so like it just boomed into the early aughts, and then it just kind of like, you know, the roaring 20s into the great market crash of like 1929, whatever, it just came crashing down. Mm-hmm. And the people that suffered were young adults coming into, you know, their prime. And so you go into, you paid all this money to go to college. And, you know, if you see it all the way through, you get this degree, it meant nothing once you got into the job force. And then you're saddled with student debt, which just was like essentially unregulated in terms of the supply demand, like free market capitalism, essentially again. And so I think, you know, consumers, they're more skeptical. They want to trust, you know, brands and institutions because they lost trust. They want to see more transparently. What do you really stand for? What are you going to do with my information? What are you going to do with my money? Like, why should I trust you? Why should I give you money? And so I think that like the blind consumer culture, capitalism, especially of the 90s into 2000s, is like, I love Nike, but like, what were they doing in terms of their work practices, right? It was just like the whole globalization of stuff. There were so many blind spots that people missed. And so I think consumers today, even Gen Z, which is younger than us, there's no faking the funk. They see, you know, climate change. They see that inequality. They see all this stuff. It's just front and center. You can't like deny it. And so I think people want a lot more from their brands. I think for us, that's why we said direct with consumer. We're trying to be, again, it goes back to like the small town general store before mass, you know, highway systems created big box retailers, which started this whole trend of things being impersonal. We're trying to do intimacy at scale and be personal and talk to people. They say, hey, why did you do this? I don't like this. This didn't work. Just talk back. Listen to them. What's so radical about that? I think businesses should be like people. Mm-hmm. They should have values. They should stand for stuff that you want to align yourself with. They should admit when they're wrong. They should take responsibility. They should say sorry. They should engage in dialogue and conversation versus all advertising and media is designed to be broadcast-based. It just shoots one way and shut up and consume. You know, or just get out of my way versus actually trying to customer lifetime value, et cetera. Like, you can put your numbers behind it, but what really you should do is try to build a relationship. Right. And I think if you look at, again, Patagonia or other brands, people say, I like what you stand for. I want to support you and I want to be treated right. I want to be part of your tribe. We've lost a lot of like our normal tribes. Young people don't go to religious stuff as more. We all move to cities. There's nowhere lonelier than being in a big city when you don't know everyone. So I think people are gravitating towards businesses to try to find their tribe. So I think understanding the responsibility that comes with being a business and market that sells stuff to people. And so that's part of our push also is like, just be more responsible as a business. Just because it's easier accepted doesn't mean to do it. And that's what I was saying before about like fighting gravity. It's like pushing back on the expected. Mm-hmm. Just do it for yourself of what is right. And you'll be rewarded because that's what a lot of consumers are looking and expecting now.
I think a lot of companies don't do what you're saying because it's unscalable, right? But a lot of times the most unscalable things is what will help you stand out. Talking to customers,
100%.
Being personal. And it's cool to see new brands latching onto this, but also some of the classic brands who are noticing. And it's really interesting time to be in this industry, right? I think that is a beautiful way to end. Can you tell people where to find you and Pattern?
Patternbrands.com. Check it out. You know, Instagram, Pattern Brands. And then our first brand, Equal Parts, equalparts.com. Got that URL.
Congrats on that URL.
Yeah.
Can I ask how much it was?
I think it was like $5,000-$6,000. It was a guy in San Francisco who made this site. It was, he did poetry for his daughter.
Oh, wow.
Who was biracial, and so he made a site with poetry for Equal Parts. And so he liked our mission, and he liked what we were about, and so he was kind enough to sell it to us.
Yeah, because that might seem like a lot, but that's actually a pretty good deal.
Yeah, no, it was good. So yeah, we're online, and just true to form, if you listen to this, hit me up. Yeah. My name's Emmett Schein. Just, you know, if you have questions, like stuff, don't like stuff, just let's talk.
It was such a pleasure talking to you, Emmett. And again, thank you, Sarah. Guys, everything will be in the description below. Check him out. Check out Pattern. And thank you so much for being on.
Woo, fire podcast. Emmett is so wise. I mean, truly wise. So I really appreciate us hanging out and our mutual friend, Nick, for hooking it up. I'm really glad that you guys were able to listen to that one because I've thoroughly enjoyed it. So time for questions. I feel like I need a special song for this, like Sarah answering questions on That Creative Life. Okay, I'm sorry I just did that to your earballs. You guys already asked so many great questions. So I'm going to try to get through as many as possible, as quickly as possible. So here we go. At BlazePratt77 asks, if you had to choose one for life between Apple and Android, which one would it be? Hands down, Apple. I mean, I am a true lover, liker, whatever you want to call it, of the iPhone. It just doesn't get in the way. I love Android phones, but usually for certain quirks, something about iOS, even though, well, it's been pretty spotty lately, it's pretty buggy. iOS typically just works the way you need it to work. And with pictures and video, everything is just the way I like it. A better question maybe would have been macOS or Windows, because if you asked me that question 3 years ago, I would say, are you kidding me? Windows, macOS for life. But as you know, my journey to the dark side, to Windows over the past 2 years, hasn't been that difficult. And I've actually been enjoying it. And the more you get used to it, there's a little bit of a learning curve, but you learn things are kind of exactly the same over there. And some things that are different, you might actually like better on Windows. This is crazy. Like, I enjoy Windows. There's really nothing wrong with it. So if I had to use Windows the rest of my life, I wouldn't mind it. Isn't that crazy? That's kind of crazy, but it's true. Okay, so next question. At the Chaz M, I probably am butchering all of your names. If you had unlimited resources, what one piece of tech would you create and what price would you sell it for? Such a good question. Okay. We're seeing foldable phones with the foldable glass, right? But I am on team making tablets smaller instead of making phones bigger. I like the way phones are at. You know, I have the smallest iPhone, the iPhone 11 Pro, and I love it. I think it is perfect. I don't want anything else. But when I go on the plane, when I travel, or maybe when I'm just sitting on the couch and for some reason I'm not using the TV, there are times where I'm like, this is the perfect opportunity to pull out a tablet, an iPad. But maybe if I'm traveling, I don't have extra room because I bring a laptop with me everywhere. And maybe I just want something a little bit more portable. That would be the perfect situation to have a tablet that's the size of an iPhone, but then folds out to a huge screen to watch, you know, reruns of The Office on the airplane, because I find myself on an airplane a lot. So that would be it. And I think to make that, you know, it doesn't have to be super powerful. It just has to be able to like entertain. So I think if they could make something like that around the like $800 price point that was foldable, oh, that would be the dream. That'd be great. I'm not really thinking as like selling it as a business, but as a consumer, that would be, I think, of the sweet spot. At Gustav Ray says, I want to make videos for YouTube, but I have so many ideas, different subjects and topics, for example, and I don't know how to bring them to life. Would you have any tips for me? Yes, Gustav, take the one that you're most passionate about and revolve your entire YouTube channel around that, because YouTube rewards niching down. They don't like variety stuff. So if you don't care about building an audience, you don't want YouTube to be like a job or a way to enhance your business or whatever your priorities are, then just post whatever you want and have fun, especially in the beginning. In the beginning, when there's no pressure of having an audience, that is when you have license to just make whatever videos make you happy, seriously. But when you decide to take it seriously, it does reward niching down. So pick one thing that you can revolve everything around and then use your other interests and hobbies to basically just sprinkle in here and there to make you unique, to relate to other people. At R-O-S-S-O-C-H-S says, as someone who has multiple projects going on at the same time, how do you manage your time between them? Finding this hard as I get more work. Oh, yeah. Like, Same. I think you have to just evaluate yourself, see what makes you happy. Do you need to have your weekends filled of just blissful fun and hanging out with friends? Do you need to clock out of work at 6, 7 p.m. every day and know that you can leave your phone off and just like enjoy the world? But if working and chasing your ambitions and chasing down those new ideas is what you find rewarding in your life right now, then go for it. I literally have like 4 to 5 different projects going on at the same time at all times. My YouTube channel, I view as my 9 to 5. That's what keeps money coming in. This podcast, if you notice, there's no sponsors. I would like to have sponsors on this to pay for the editor and pay for just the production of this. But I haven't found one that I like yet that actually will pay a fair fee. So I'm not wanting to sell this out to anyone or everyone. So it's really just like a glorified side project that allows me to have really cool conversations with cool creative people that I wouldn't otherwise have. I'm also building a software company right now too. That hasn't escalated to the point that it one day will be like half of my life. But again, I like doing that. I need things that are new in my life to keep me excited. So if that's you, more power to you. But if you're drowning, you got to tweak some stuff. You got to maybe hire some people, spend less time on some stuff. I don't know. It's like a self-awareness thing. Okay, last question. At Mile High Aaron says, if your YouTube career ended tomorrow, what would be your backup plan? And would it involve leaving NYC? No, it would not involve leaving NYC. This is the great thing about where I feel like I'm positioned is, guys, if my YouTube career was over tomorrow, I'm fine. Like, I make good videos. I can tell a story. So I would make videos for companies. I would maybe start a production company and storytell for brands. You know, working with brands is such a big part of my YouTube channel. I would honestly probably still be fine if I wasn't making personal content. Of course, I would have to have some fun side projects that are just for me. But I thoroughly enjoy creating within the limits that brands give you to try to spread a message or do whatever they need to do. So yeah, I would do that. I would continue trying to build creative tools for creators. I would literally be doing what I'm doing, but maybe it would be more 100% for brands and then just trying to build companies around that. I think those are some of the best YouTubers out there. I'm not, sorry if that came off weird. I'm not just trying to toot my own horn, but you can tell people who are just YouTubers to like be influencers, and then the people who are actually good at telling stories, who actually have talent, there's a certain security that you have from that of just like going forth and conquering and having confidence in that. And you know, everything I do isn't wrapped up in getting the likes and getting all this stuff. So yeah, not too worried about it. But if YouTube disappeared tomorrow, I would probably still be in New York doing my creative thing. Anyways, thank you guys so much for listening. Have you subscribed? If you haven't subscribed yet, make sure you do on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. You can come back every single Monday. We are going to have a little bit of a holiday break at the end of this month, but then we're going to come in strong, swinging 2020. Have you guys been enjoying this podcast? Because if you have, can you please leave me a review in the Apple Store? Go right now. Go. Just let me know if you've been enjoying it. Rate it with the stars. Let me know who is your favorite podcast guest so far. And then, yeah, we're going to charge confidently into 2020. Thanks for listening, guys. And I'll see you in the next one.